In Moscow, wherever you looked, wherever you turned, you could see. This was a country in mourning and in shock. Across Russia, flags flew at half-mast for the victims of the Concert Hall massacre. And at the scene of Friday's attack, Crocus City Hall, the queues grew longer and longer. The National Day of Mourning experienced most acutely here. There was an outpouring of sympathy, a mountain of tributes to the dead.
As well as leaving flowers and candles, people have also been bringing soft toys and sweets, because amongst the dead, there were children. They've also been leaving messages. One is addressed to the attackers, and it reads, "You are scum. We will never forgive you."
Among the crowd, there was a mixture of grief and anger.
It was a big shock because I live nearby and I saw it from my windows. It's horrific and a big tragedy.
This is how the attack had begun, with gunmen in the foyer and desperate attempts to take cover. The attackers moved on to the auditorium. By the end of this, more than 130 people were dead. Four suspects have been arrested. Tonight, the suspected gunmen appeared in court. Russia claims they'd been caught fleeing to Ukraine and had contacts there. Kyiv fiercely denies any link to the attack. The Islamic State group says it was behind the shooting.
Yeah, baby, it's episode 146 of Ask the Inspector on March 26, 2024. Jeff Norman with Scott Ritter. Friday night, we did a special episode featuring the music of Bob Dylan. And afterwards, Scott, you were saying that it didn't quite feel right to give short shrift, in a sense, to such a big tragedy in Moscow that happened that day. So I thought I would just acknowledge that before we got into the questions, and maybe you would like to say sort of the same thing.
Well, I put some of my thoughts down in writing. There's a new Substack that will hopefully be coming out later today that that talks about this this event and the linkage with Ukraine and the consequences thereof. This is a big deal. It's interesting that that same BBC reporter who sanctimoniously was reporting there as if he somehow gave a damn is one of the people that in stories that he publishes, in addition to this, just gives absolute short shrift to the Russian point of view, the Russian perspective, etc. And is part of the crowd that is trying to turn this into some sort of anti-Putin event. It just shows the level of ignorance that exists. If anything, this tragedy made Russia more unified, stronger, more resilient. And for the people who perpetrated, who were behind this, there will be hell to pay. And one of the things I'm afraid of is that there might be American fingerprints on this attack, and there will be hell to pay for those who put their fingerprints there.
All right, so we'll look forward to that new post coming on Substack later. The address is scottritterextra.com, so check it out, and please subscribe while you're there. This is the lightning round of Ask the Inspector. We do it every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for an hour, and Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. Friday night is the loquacious version for 2 hours, and Scott answers everything much more extensively. We will not have our usual episode this coming Friday, but we'll be back the following week, as usual, Tuesday and Friday. The first question is from Alibek Nazarov in Moscow. How would you react to the Crocus attack if you were the Russian president?
I would react by showing leadership to the Russian people, by expressing my absolute sorrow for what happened. I would assure the Russian people that, the government is there in control, and that, the government will take care of the victims of this attack, and that the government will hold those who perpetrated the attack accountable for their actions. And then I would insist on a very immediate and thorough investigation that provided me with all the facts necessary for me to make appropriate follow-on decisions.
Okay, next question is from, well, hang on a second. Let me stop the clock, first of all. Next question is from Michael in Portsmouth, England. Do you think the reaction to what Putin will do is similar to the same scenario Netanyahu has had happen to his people on October 7th? How do you compare the two?
Oh, there's no comparison whatsoever. October 7th was a reaction of an occupied people against an illegal occupier. It's linked to decades of wrongdoing by Israel against the Palestinian people. So there's just literally no linkage whatsoever. The terrorist attack on Moscow has no such, any incomparable activity. It's an act perpetrated by a Ukrainian government that wanted this war, that pushed for this war, that got this war, and now things aren't going well for them, and they are reaching out to carry out. You know, if they can't win on the battlefield, they're going to try and win off the battlefield. But there's no linkage whatsoever between Netanyahu and October 7th and what happened in Moscow.
Next question is from Alex Jones fan. Alex Jones has woken up. I don't know if that's correct grammar, but whatever. And is speaking like you about Russia and Gaza. Would you please go on his show and educate his audience more?
Gladly. They invite me. I'll say yes.
This Alex Jones fan may not know that you've been on at least a couple of times in the past few months. So
yeah, it's not an unknown occurrence.
Right. And in fact, I was with my favorite weapons inspector when Scott was in the studio in Austin a few months ago. So anyway, but maybe he knows that and he just wants you on more, as he says. The next question is from Arena in Germany. The EU announced that it's establishing a weapons production facility in Ukraine. They can't possibly think that Russia will not target those plants during the conflict. So what's the purpose of such announcements?
It's a feel-good statement. The European Union, like NATO, like the United States, like everybody, is recognizing their impotence in the face of what is an inevitable Russian victory in Ukraine. This is a throwaway statement. I can't imagine there's any investor or any business that will say, yeah, this is a good idea. Let's go break ground in Ukraine. You might as well just dig a hole 6 feet deep and lay down in it and have them cover you up, because that's what the end result is going to be. This factory will never get off the ground. Anybody who's involved in the building of this factory will die. If I were the Russians, I'd let you break ground. I'd let you put in a couple $1 billion worth of manufacturing support. And then at the appropriate time, I would just take it out. Boom, and say start all over if you want. We can do this all day. But it's a joke.
Okay. We have a voicemail message from Gihan in Australia.
Hi, Scott and Jeff. My name is Gihan from Darwin, Australia. And I'd like to ask Scott to comment on Nasrallah of Hezbollah's words about telling the Palestinian people to stay strong because their resistance is hurting the Israeli army, and that Israel is actually falling apart economically as well. Can you please comment on that? Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. What Nasrallah is speaking is truth. The Israeli economy has been devastated by this conflict. The actions of the Houthi have caused, Israel's one of Israel's major ports, Eilat, to shut down. There's nothing coming in, nothing going out. In the north, Israel's had to evacuate the towns and villages, and in the north. So you have, you know, a huge refugee population that has to be accommodated. The same thing with the population that lived around Gaza. They've been evacuated. The jobs aren't happening. Investments aren't happening. Israel had hinged its future on the India Middle East economic corridor that Israel is supposed to play an important connectivity role in. That's not happening. The Israelis are going bankrupt. Their economy is in tatters, and it's going to lead to depopulation as people flee Israel for safer places. The Israeli army is hurting very badly. They're demoralized, and they can't sustain the level of conflict that's level the operational tempo that's been in place. So I think what he's saying is, you know, you've come this far, you're near the finish line. Don't quit.
All right, I forgot to start the clock on that one, but I think you answered that in less than 3 minutes. So you don't even need me, Scott. You don't even need me, Dave from Olympia. The audience is not going. Yeah, no shit, Sherlock. Dave from Olympia, Washington. Why has Russia not destroyed or captured all of the CIA bases in Ukraine yet?
Well, how do you know they haven't destroyed them? I don't know where they are. Do you know where they are? So I'm not in a position to say, well, five of the 12 bases have survived, because I don't know where any of the 12 bases physically are located. Russia might, and if they do, I imagine they've struck them, and then the Ukrainians and the CIA probably relocated them if they still have an operational value. You can only occupy the bases if they're located in territory that you occupy or in the process of occupying. Again, we don't know if the Russians have occupied any of these bases, and we don't know that if they have occupied them, that they know that they were that, because I would imagine that prior to being evacuated, documents and evidence of covert activity would be eliminated. So who knows right now, but it doesn't matter. The CIA is engaged in helping Ukraine carry out activities of resistance against Russia, and they're a target, and Russia will target them and deal with them as they find them.
All right. How about the question that's on the screen right now? Why hasn't Putin made Ukraine a non-flying zone? Chris from London is asking.
Well, I think it's why does he need to make it a non-flying zone? And what benefit does he gain from it? What risks are entailed? To make it a non-flying zone would require you to maintain a combat air patrol over Ukraine continuously. That means that you're exposing your forces to anti-aircraft fire. And maybe Russia made the decision that the best way to use its air force isn't to get involved in a war for war's sake, but rather to use the air force to, achieve, more identifiable and quantifiable objectives, like dropping glide bombs on frontline positions, things of that nature, to preserve your airframes for any potential future expansion of the conflict. So I just don't think that Russia feels that a no-fly zone is worth the effort it would take to create it.
Okay, next question is from the Pope in Darwin, Australia. Following the relief of Mariupol by the Russians, it was claimed that retired U.S. Admiral Eric Olson was captured. Fact checkers claim this to be false, as they would, which implies that the opposite is true. Do you have any information on the current whereabouts of the retired admiral?
Well, gosh, using your philosophy, if I that's not Olson.
It's not. That's what the questioner submitted with his question. That's not him.
Right, right. But the fact that I'm saying it's not apparently means that it is, according to his logic. No, that's not Olson. That's not how it works, guys. Olson would never be allowed to be put in that situation. He knows too much. He would never be exposed in that fashion, and that's just stupid. I don't mean that you're stupid, Mr. Pope. I'm saying that the notion that that Olsen was captured by the Ukrainians is, frankly speaking, just stupid.
Well, it was one thing to call me an idiot a few weeks ago, but to call the Pope an idiot, you're going straight to hell, sir.
Well, that may be, but I didn't call him an idiot.
All right. I mean, I don't know. I'm not that much of a believer, but I don't know if I want to take my chances just in case, you know.
Just in case.
Kenneth in Norway, now that Russia is on the offensive and clearly will grind the enemy to a defeat, how can NATO and the West come out of this with some of their reputation intact? Saving face is what it's all about.
Well, at some point in time, you just got to draw the line and call it a loss. It's like going to Vegas. You get on a table and you start giving them chips. And at some point in time, you got to go, I'm probably going to keep giving them chips all night. Maybe the best way to win is just to limit the number of chips I've already given to them and walk away from the table. We keep doubling down. We've mortgaged the house, taking the kids college. We put it all on there and the casino just keeps taking it away. And, the only way we can save face is to save face that remains. You can't reconstruct the face that has been lost.
Okay. How about a voicemail message from Katarina in Berlin?
Hi, Scott. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Katarina.
Hi, team, Yelena, and Maverick, of course. It's Katarina Eva. Russian Polish, living in Berlin. I was just thinking about one fact that it's not being spoken about in the Western media, I think, and it's also not so widely known now in Poland, which is very sad. It wasn't just Russians, even though I'm proud of being Russian, liberated Berlin, that was also Polish army, and they did it together. And the only parade that Polish army was allowed to be at was the Moscow parade, not in London, not anywhere else, just in Moscow. That says a lot. Russophobia in Poland is fake. It comes from above, and we love all Russians. That's all I want to say. And I love all the Poles. Love you guys.
A lot of love there. Any comment from the weapons inspector?
Well, I mean, first of all, when she says the Polish army, she's talking about now. I have, I think there are two governments. One was the London-based government, which was the Poles who fled the Nazi occupation to the West and established themselves in London. And they were basically used by Winston Churchill to create leverage so that when the conflict ended, Poland would be in the Western sphere, not in the Russian sphere. And then there was the Lublin government, which was created by the Soviet Union. And this was derived from Poles, communists who aligned themselves with Russia. And the Polish army that she speaks of, because there were two Polish armies, there was another Polish army fighting for the West. They bravely fought in Italy and in the latter stages in Europe. The Polish army that helped liberate Berlin was, from the Lublin government. The West hated them. The West didn't recognize them. The West despised them. And so the West would never recognize them as being the legitimate, face of Poland. And yet these were Polish patriots who had been given short shrift because, in the period after the collapse of the Soviet Union and then the fall of the Warsaw Pact, anti-Russian, anti-Soviet political elites took control, and they started to try and, rewrite history or put new emphasis on certain parts of history. And anything that was seen as being pro-Soviet or sympathetic to Soviets was demonized and put down. And so their history has been forgotten. But I think as the young lady from Berlin has noted, that there is a significant Polish population that has good feelings towards the Russian people. And indeed, the Russian military, or their their predecessors, the Soviet military, not everything Russia does is bad. In fact, a lot of what Russia does is good. And remember, the Poles suffered greatly under German occupation, Nazi occupation, and many Poles view the Russians coming as liberators.
All right. Russia bad. Orange man bad. That's sometimes the extent of the analysis. Gabor Szilvay. I'm sure that's wrong. Sorry, Gabor. Gabor. There's the accent on the first syllable, in Helsinki. Your comments to Nima about Finland were not helpful. These are stubborn people, and telling them that their country may no longer exist after Russia defeats the collective West is not the way to make them see reason. Rather, you are stoking their traditional and currently intensified fear.
Okay.
You've just been scolded, Scott.
I've been scolded. I mean, my goodness. I'm sorry. What am I supposed to say? tickle the bear and the bear eats you. He's not going to eat you. Don't worry about the Russians. Do whatever the hell you want. Invite NATO in. Hell, attack St. Petersburg while you're at it, guys. Why not split your army in half and have some go across to take the Kola Peninsula? I mean, you're the Finns, you're stubborn. I don't want to hurt your sensitivity, guys. So go ahead and do all these stupid games. It's, you know, attack the Russians, play with them. Nothing bad's going to happen, except you'll no longer exist. If that hurts your feelings, I don't care. Because, frankly speaking, I'm pissed off at you because you took a nice situation where you were given the right to live. Oh, did I hurt the poor little Finnish thing again? You guys fought with the Nazis, right? You fought alongside the Nazis. You sieged Leningrad. You helped kill a million people. You're lucky to be alive today. The Russians allowed you to live because you said you would be neutral in perpetuity. I don't know what the Finnish word for perpetuity is, but I know what the English word is. I just said it. It means for frickin' ever. And you decided you didn't want to play that game, and you're aligning yourself with a military alliance whose goal is the strategic defeat of what? Russia. Did you not learn a goddamn thing? I'm sorry. Am I hurting the sensitivities of the poor little Finnish people? I don't give a shit. You mother you-know-whaters are getting involved in something that's going to drag my country into it. The American people are going to pay the price for your freaking stupidity. Did I hurt your feelings? Good. Pound sand. Next question.
Scotty's on fire!
Now comes documentary evidence of our visit to the Alex Jones. No. Of our this is called an abrupt segue into something else. Now comes documentary evidence of our visit to Alex Jones' studio in Austin.
Who's that bald guy on the far end there?
That's our new Friday night girl, Ryan Milton, who I think might be moderating the chat in Rumble today.
If we're going to call him our Friday girl, do we need to get him a wig and have him get a pedicure or something? Because he's looking pretty rough.
That's your opinion. I think he's very effeminate. By the way, backstage today is Yelena, back after a brief absence due to time change confusion. Hey, what's the Finnish word for perpetuity? That's what we need to find out now. Anybody out there know the Finnish word for
Patty Patlazan is Finnish, so she could tell us but she says is right. Hopefully she means me, but she might mean the guy who
asked. Can't tell. Let's assume she means me. Let's assume she means me. That, in others, we were really in Austin. I'm right about that. Yeah. Hush! In Toronto, what is being done to take back, which is to say decolonize, the U.S. from AIPAC?
Well, I don't know if there's any concerted effort to do this. But, I mean, in order to do that, you'd have to basically get AIPAC to register as a foreign agent and therefore delegitimize much of the work that they're doing in America to undermine American democracy. And the first step is to get... is to recognize the relationship between the United States and Israel. You can't solve a problem unless you've adequately defined the problem to begin with, because then if you don't do that, no solution's out there. And you know, once we recognize that Israel and America have no common interests, that Israel is being used by American political elites, primarily Jewish, but oftentimes also evangelical Christians who believe in some sort of perverted notion of Armageddon, derived from some weird reading of a part of the Bible that was not written by anybody except some insane person, but the Catholics incorporated in through the Council of Trent. I mean, we can get in the whole Book of Revelations and its origins and its legitimacy and how everybody suddenly believes in the four horsemen of the apocalypse riding around to the end of times. You know, the irony of it is, you know, for all you Christians out there who believe in this nonsense, God is almighty, is he not? Can man really sway God? Because what you're telling me is you Christian Zionists want to go out there and help the Israelis bring about Armageddon. Baby, it's going to happen. God wills it. You ain't going to be able to pressure God into doing anything. So why not just sit back and enjoy the ride and let me not worry about you trying to promote some sort of ridiculous Armageddon fantasy? And the same thing with, you know, the Americans who use Israel as leverage to empower themselves, because that's what about AIPAC is about, the empowerment of an American Jewish political elite here in America. It's not about helping Israel. It's about using Israel to empower them. And until we recognize that and call it out for what it is, AIPAC will continue to, you know, play the stupid games that they play.
Okay. I see that our stream to Facebook has failed. And I do not think it's because of censorship, because I saw that some changes are afoot at Facebook as far as how their streams are set up. So hopefully we'll get that situation solved by the time of our next episode. And I hope that those who were trying to watch on Facebook somehow found us on Twitch, X, Locals, or Rumble.
Go ahead. You finish, and then I want to
say. One last thing I want to say is that if you're ever having trouble finding us, just go to scottritter.com and there'll be links to everything, scottritter.com, if all else fails. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, you know, we're trying to woo the Twitch community, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that one of our objectives? Is to
absolutely. And I spoke with our friend in Tampa today.
Oh, well, we'll have to talk about that later. But here's the deal. For all you Twitchers out there, do we have any Twitchers on? Do I see any Twitch things? I don't see.
Well, we had at least one comment from Twitch that we already used before. So something.
Oh, well, thank you, Twitch. Okay, here's to the Twitchers out there. You guys are a gaming community, and anybody out there who's a gamer can talk. One of our goals here is to try and reach out to different demographics. And an important demographic is the college demographic, the youth. And a lot of them access their news through Twitch. So here's an idea. What do you think about it? If we created something we'd put on here, using World of Warcraft, maybe, as the vehicle to raid with Ritter. But the idea is that we would live stream a World of Warcraft event where a team of people, including professional gamers and geopolitical analysts, would raid and switch and do World of Warcraft and talk geopolitics at the same time. Is that something you think that the Twitch community would be interested in? If you think so, put it in the comments. I'm not allowed to read the comments, but Jeff and Ryan can. I might read.
Well, and Yelena. So Yelena is really who we're talking to. So if anybody responds to that, Yelena, please insert those comments. A little marketing survey in real time.
Discord.
Well done, Major. Well done. Our next question.
Call of Duty. Sorry, I'm reading.
Well, at least they're in the same planet as you are with the gaming. So.
Wolfino, dude, that's all.
Wolfino in Copenhagen, Denmark. Why are Palestinians not using man pads? Isn't that what Fred uses? No, sorry, bad joke. In Gaza.
Ooh, Hoffman. We brought in Hoffman.
A Hoffman reference. Always got to get it in somehow. Why are they not using man pads in Gaza? Destroying a military helicopter would be a major military victory. And good for morale.
Well, if you take a look at the videos that the Hamas puts out there, they show a lot of these RPGs. and they show them crawling through, finding a gap in the wall. And then you see them pop up, fire the RPG, and then get the hell out of Dodge. Why? Because Israel has a constant intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance system overlaid over Gaza. And so if you come bitty bopping out with your RPG going, hey, let me take a well-aimed shot here in the open, they're going to kill you. You have to pop up, fire, and go away. And Hamas is very good at that. Now, man pads. I got to come out with a man pad, and I've got to acquire the target. I have to track the target. I have to get the system. It has to tone in. I have to be standing out in the open. There's going to be a considerable backblast, so I can't be inside a building. And so while I'm doing all this stuff to attract that helicopter and to get the tone and make sure I have a lock on, I'm going to die. That's why they're not using man pads in Gaza, because it's very difficult to use man pads when the exposure time is greater than the response time.
Okay, moving on to our next question from Justin in Perth, Australia. What will it take for the people of the West to adjust to the fact that the unipolar world is gone, 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 and we need to contend with other significant powers? A nuclear exchange? As level-headed as they are, there is only so much provocation the likes of Russia and China can handle.
Well, let's put it this way. I'm trying to come up with the appropriate analogy here, but if you had something nipping at your legs that you didn't even notice, would you care? You just sort of shoo it away. It's not really a provocation. It's a annoyance. Russia,
Chihuahua.
China, I didn't want to criticize Chihuahuas because I got one. And he's
gonna all right.
He hears bad things. the point is, you know, Russia's past the point of caring about what Scott Ritter thinks in Delmar, New York, or what the gentleman thinks in Perth, Australia. We no longer register on their radar, and it's our own fault. We divorced from them. We're much like a spurned spouse who filed for divorce, and now that it's gone through, and we're calling up, please take me back. Please, I want to be relevant in your life again. And the other person going, done signed the papers. I'm moving on. Russia's moving on. So what we would think is being provocative, Russia doesn't even care anymore. You know, how many times have we sanctioned Russia? Do you think additional sanctions, Russians are going to go, well, that's really provocative. Now I'm going to overreact. No, Russia doesn't care. They've moved on. China, they're making themselves, they literally at the point where they don't care. You know, we were going to play with their stupid chips. You know, we're going to deny you access to Western chip technology. And the Chinese went, okay, we'll build our own. And they have. They don't care. They're just moving on. So I don't think that it's that the Chinese and the Russians have to change behavioral patterns to accommodate us. I think we have to change our behavioral patterns to accommodate them. And if we continue to believe that we're relevant without doing this, then we're just going to find ourselves way in the back and struggling to catch up. Multipolarity is a reality. I'll be going to Russia in October to the city of Kazan, and I will be monitoring the BRICS conference and reporting from there. It's going to be one of the most important international gatherings of this year and maybe of this decade. And why? Because it is the event that's going to mark a fundamental transition away from the world as it is today, American dominated, American singularity, to a new multipolar world where Russia and China will factor in a major way.
All right. How about another voicemail message, Scott? This one, I may have to crank up the volume on this, but let's see.
Scott, is the US and NATO and Europe trying to bluff Russia into defeat?
That is an outstanding question, because I'll tell you why. Because the popular thought process is that Russia's trying to bluff its way into success And you hear this in the West. Russia's just bluffing about nuclear weapons. They're never going to use nuclear weapons. They're not as strong. They put everything up front, but they're really a hollow, da, 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 da. But you did well here. This is a good question, because that's exactly what's happening. You have the French right now huffing and puffing, but they can't blow down the house, but they're threatening to blow down the house. We're going to send thousands of troops into Ukraine. No, you're not. You can't. Because if you do, you're going to die. But you're bluffing. You're trying to get the Russians to go, oh, damn, maybe they're serious about doing that. Do we really want to tangle with the French? I mean, they got the Mamba air defense system. I don't know if it's any good, but it sounds dangerous. The Mamba, black Mamba snake. It bites you, you die. Oh, my God. Oh, geez, Europe. America, you know, we're America. So what? What do you got? Nothing anymore. Nothing. We had to reduce the army by 24,000 billets. At a time when Congress says to expand, we had to shrink. Why? 60,000 short in our recruiting, 64,000 short in our recruitment. Nobody wants to join. We're shrinking. We don't have troops to send. The Poles are like, send in more Americans. We're like, no, we can't. We don't have any more to send. We are bluffing our way to get the Russians to back down, to get the Russians to say, maybe we got this wrong. Maybe NATO's stronger than they appear to be. Maybe America is more capable than they appear to be, because they're making all these strong statements and these aggressive posturing. So brilliant question. And I actually think that the answer to that is yes, the West is trying to bluff its way into victory.
All right. Scotty's not always on fire, or if he is, sometimes it's in a very complimentary way. Brilliant question.
That was a brilliant question.
I hear you. Give credit where it's due. Andrew from White Sands, not that one. Now that there are U.S. special forces in Kinmen, what action should China take to stop the rest of the camel from coming into their tent? If military action were taken and U.S. forces killed, might it lead to nuclear war?
It might. Just to answer a question in chat that I just saw before I get to this, I play a rogue in outlaw rogue. It used to be called a combat rogue. I loved it because it was called a combat rogue, but when they transitioned to outlaw rogue, I've never really been able to pick up the rotations and everything, but I've only played one character and that's it. So I hope that answered the question. Now on Taiwan, no, you could have kept me on the timer. I was going to make it. I mean, this is the danger. We put special forces on Kinmen. I think Kinmen is either Quemoy or Matsu. I can't remember which one it is. Or maybe both. But it's literally right off the coast of mainland China. Strategically, the island has no importance. It's just it's a nuisance. It's a harassment. The presence of U.S. special forces on the island is a gimmick. They can't do anything. But they're there. It's like a tripwire. It's like saying because the first step for any Chinese invasion of Taiwan would be to take the island. And so by having U.S. special forces there, we've created a tripwire. So basically we're saying, if you come in and take this island, you're going to have to kill 50 American special forces. And that's a red line that we won't let you cross. And the Chinese will say, we don't care. Boom, you're all dead. And we're moving on. Because if they're going to invade Taiwan, they've already made a decision that we will probably end up with a shooting match with America. And they're not going to let 50 special forces get in the way of the bigger game. So It's a dangerous action, but at the end of the day, it's literally, it's nothing. It's a political move. It's not the nose of the camel, because there has to be a camel behind it. It's as if the camel, if you want to call it a camel, it's all in the nose, and it comes in and all you have is the nose, and then you just throw the nose out. There has to be something more attached to it. And that's the problem, is that the United States doesn't have any more to attach to it. We're so weak. That there's nothing there that we can construct that says this is the camel that's coming into the tent.
And that's the name of Scott's latest Substack post, The Camel's Nose, that you can read at scottritterextra.com. Apparently that metaphor has caught on. And you know what else caught on today, Scott? I used the phrase short shrift in the opening chat, and then you subsequently have used that same term twice, total of three times.
Short. Well, we gotta mix it up.
Yeah.
Get a more diverse lexicon.
Well, I just feel good that I have established a new catchphrase. I am a game changer.
Game changers. Changes to the game such that the game can never be played the same way again.
Be Benet Geoforce and you be Mongolia. Can you talk more about the Russian nuclear weapons storage facility near Belgorod City? Is that the reason Ukrainian special forces keep attacking in that region?
Well, what I'll say is this. I would think that anything that might be called a nuclear weapons storage facility near Belgorod is something that was built during the time of the Soviet Union. And that it no longer has nuclear weapons. You wouldn't put nuclear weapons forward deployed. And that, first of all, there's no reason to. The Russians don't do tactical nuclear weapons anymore. And so, you know, they don't need to have nuclear bombs there for any airfield nearby that might have tactical aircraft taking off, or they don't need to have artillery shells there to send out with artillery units. Plus, it's vulnerable that close to the Ukrainian border. Even if they had nuclear weapons there at one point in time, I'd get them the hell out, because Ukraine's shown a proclivity to send in, you know, raiding teams. And the last thing you want is Ukrainian raiders to take over a nuclear storage facility and gain access to nuclear material. So I don't think there's any nuclear weapons located anywhere near Belgorod. I think if there are nuclear weapons, and there are, they're back further in the rear. These are weapons that are linked to the delivery means that Russia has, which will be, you know, strategic aircraft, or if they're related to tactical aircraft, if and when Russia decides they need to forward deploy that capability, they'll go forward into facilities like Belgorod. But before that happened, the Russians would have to secure that entire region, because, you know, to make sure that there's no vulnerability there. But I think that the facility you're talking about is a former Soviet facility that currently does not have any nuclear weapons in it. It would be mind-boggling if Russia would put nuclear weapons in that facility, given how close it is to the Ukrainian border and given just the level of insecurity that exists today.
All right. El Kanta, who claims to live somewhere in the United States of America, how would we know if that's the truth? But that's the allegation. It looks like the combined West is more concerned about Crimea and Odessa. If the French troops advance from Romania to defend Odessa, what options do Russians have without destroying that gem of a city?
You've seen the Monty Python movies, things that make you go, what options do they have? I'd say killing Frenchmen. That's the best option. And the second a French boot lands in Ukrainian soil, it should be targeted by a Russian munition. And you should kill every Frenchman that you can as soon as they enter, and don't let them get anywhere near Odessa. But even if they get near Odessa, they're going to die anyways. I mean, I think France hopefully is coming to the, although they're not, they just mobilized a regiment and earmarked it for deployment to Ukraine through Romania. So maybe we'll get back to that other question that they're bluffing, you know, Russia into believing that they're going to do something. But the reality is that I don't think Russia is going to allow France to embed itself in a meaningful fashion in Ukraine. That the moment France commits to that action, the Russians will seek to interdict decisively as early as possible.
Okay. And that's really all the questions we have this week. You answered them all very briefly. We didn't have any phone calls to take up time. So
we can take questions from the audience.
Yeah. How about Yelena? You got any good comments from the audience? Are you there, Yelena? I see her looking pensively. Come up with a good one. Pressure's on, Yelena. She was having internet problems before, so there's a little bit of a lag. Here we go.
Hey, Scott. Okay.
Do you have any thoughts on Canada's odds of not going down with the deep state war machine? I think our odds are about 90% that we go down with the master's quests.
I mean, first of all, I think that Canada can insulate itself sufficiently from the United States and not necessarily go down with the Titanic. But, you know, in order to do that, the dogs are energetic. In order to do that, you'd have to find a way to, you know, de-link yourself sufficiently. And right now, it seems that the trend in Canada is to make closer linkage. And in that case, you're in trouble. But it's not impossible to envision a scenario where Canada can de-link themselves.
All right. What else you got, Yolanda? Anything? Scott's killing his microphone there. Come on. We want to hear the what's really going on at Casa de Ritter. Who are these U.S. colonels and generals that are, quote, retired, posting on X nonstop for Ukraine aid? Do you guess they're part of the money trail? Thanks in advance. Is that what TIA stands for? I've never seen that. I'm guessing.
That's a good, that's a, I hope it stands for that.
It's also the Spanish word for aunt.
So he's calling me either an aunt or he's thanking me in advance. So yeah, I'll go with thank you in advance. Right. You know, let's put it this way. There's, I'm my Siri, Voldemort, otherwise known as Mrs. Ritter, my lovely wife, Marina, has put a lot of pressure on me to grow up. She isn't here today, so I had my irresponsible outburst against the Finns, which I'm sure I'll be called upon to apologize for at some point. but she wants me to start acting my age and acting in a manner that, you know, tries to be respectful of the people who ask questions and of the situation that I found myself in, where people look to me for cogent, coherent, and, you know, accurate and dispassionate answers to questions, difficult questions. But having said that, I engage in the occasional Twitter war with some of these so-called colonels. One of them is Gary Tabak. He's a former Navy captain, worked in the former Soviet Union and Russia as a quasi, who knows what it was. He calls himself an arms control guy. I don't know what he is, but right today he's running a grift in Ukraine. He has done something weird with his facial hair, and he is, he poses with a right sector flag. He just posed a photograph where he's wearing a Kraken patch. That's a Nazi unit affiliated with Azov, the worst of the worst murderers. But he's in Ukraine running a grift. He's there, pretending to be collecting money for the Ukrainian cause and uses it to enrich himself. There's another guy, Jeff Fisher. He's a retired Air Force colonel in Austria. He posts a lot. And his grift is that he's painted himself to be some sort of Ukraine conflict, NATO-Russia conflict expert, and he sells his expertise, and he helps promote himself through his Twitter. So there's most of the people you see out there who actively align themselves with Ukraine are involved in some sort of grift, some sort of a side hustle. Some people could say the same of me, and they can call what Jeff and I are doing a side hustle. But you know, that's fine. Except I would say that I do go out of my way to actually be well-informed and to be there on the right side of history and to be accurate, as opposed to Tabak and Jeff Fisher, who are just promoting NAFO style propaganda. And that's the other thing. If they're linked to NAFO, they're a frickin' joke.
Funny you should say that. I have a friend, a Facebook friend who's from Russia, who was complaining that she's basically questioning your credibility because you make money at this. To which I reply, well, don't all professional analysts make some amount of money? So well, I don't quite understand.
Yeah, I don't get that. I mean, Jeff knows, because we've had this conversation in private, that I'm very sensitive to the perception that I'm cashing in on this. But, you know, I write. I mean, my God. So if you like my articles, if someone says, I'm going to pay you X amount of money to write an article, and I write the article, and you go, that's a great article. I wrote it for money. Does that undermine my credibility? I mean, how the hell do you want me to write? I mean, you know, I've got to eat. If all I do is write and give it away, how do I eat? Right. I got to go work, but I can't write if I have to go work. So writing has become a full-time job. I get money. Now people want this whole podcast thing. We started this thing, and originally I told Jeff, I don't have the time to do this. Jeff and I fought about, you know, not fought, but we had intense conversations about
I don't recall this fight.
No, you wanted me to do two.
Oh, well, all right.
You're putting pressure on me to do two. And I'm sitting there going, I don't have the time to do it. And he's like, well, why don't you cancel some of the other podcasts you do and just focus on the one you do? The point is, and my answer was, because I'm not here to make money. I'm here to get ideas out. I'm here to do things. But Jeff then wisely said, well, if you don't make money, how are you going to pay your bills? How are you going to do that? If you're, you know, because you're giving all this time to podcasts, why don't you at least do one that makes you some income? The bottom line is, I've gotten over it. We're not here running a grift. What you see is what you get. And, you know, if you want to donate and sustain it, we thank you tremendously. But whether I was paid for this podcast or you know, or if this podcast doesn't generate any income, it won't change what you're getting from me. That's the difference.
Right. That's the, yeah, it's like one to say you're making money is like one quarter of an argument, of a potential argument. The rest of it would have to be that you don't really believe what you're saying, or that you're picking some path that's more lucrative than another path. But all I got from this person was you're making money. So I'm like, okay.
Yeah, it's
so
like
who doesn't make money from doing their work? No, you know?
But here's the thing, you know, let's look at the CNN guys, because, you know, I despise them with a passion. And I'll tell you why, because I used to do that for a living. I used to be a talking head. I was paid by NBC for 6 months to show up and give expert opinion, but they paid me a monthly salary. It wasn't a per appearance fee. So they paid me and I was on call, and then I would respond as necessary. Fox News started doing that. They paid me to show up on Fox News. But you know, what happened is Fox News made it apparent that they made a mistake, and they thought I was going to go one direction and I wouldn't. And, you know, so what Fox News ended up paying me to do is sit at home and do jack squat, and wouldn't allow me to go on air because they said, we own your contract. But, you know, I used to do that. They don't do that nowadays. You know, there might be some very special people that get big attract, you know, to bring them in. But all these people you see, all these colonels and generals and everything, it's by appearance. And let me tell you about how by appearance works. Producer calls you up and says, hey, Scott, there was an attack in Moscow. What do you think? I think America did it. Click.
Right, right. Well, hold on. There apparently is somebody who gets paid. You must have seen this brouhaha over Ronna McDaniel on NBC. No, I saw that,
but she's the exception. Yeah. She's the exception. Yeah,
yeah. The most nauseating thing in the world to see these assholes acting like they're otherwise credible, and this changes their otherwise pure news network into something impure?
Yeah, no. But the thing is, all these people that appear on, Malcolm Nance, our favorite you know, guy, he got paid by appearance. And so what you learn when your paycheck, now your supplemental income, is you become addicted to it. You got to, you'll go, wow, I got a nice check here. I'm going to go ski. I'm going to go this, that, and the other thing, but I want to do it next month too. How do I do that? Every time a producer calls, I have to say what they want to hear so I can go on air. So they call and we have a conversation, and then I commit to the party line, the narrative. Then they bring me on and I say what they want. You're not allowed to say what you think, feel, or anything else. You have to commit to the narrative. And the moment you deviate from the narrative, they don't call again and you don't get paid. Every single one of them is a whore. Straight up.
So the evidence is to the contrary of what my Facebook friend alleged. The evidence is that Scott doesn't do it for the money. Let's get a question in from our friend Valley. And I'm so glad that she labeled this a question, because I otherwise would have thought it was a demand or something else. I would have been just so confused. But thank you, Valley, for clarifying that this is indeed a question. Could the Baltimore Bridge collapse be something more than an accident?
Well, I mean, could, sure. We don't know. I mean, they're doing an investigation right now. I'm sure they're going to pull out, you know, they're going to go down and take a look at the power plant. Apparently ship lost power. They declared a mayday. So, you know, you have the radio call, mayday, mayday, mayday. They're going to go back and reverse engineer all the things. I'm sure there's cameras in there. They're going to see whether or not it was a manually created Mayday or if it was a real malfunction. And they'll get to the bottom line of this. First of all, I think one of the reasons why people point out is that apparently it turns out that the captain is of Ukrainian descent. They're like, oh, Ukrainians are getting revenge. But remember, it'd have to be everybody in on this. The captain just sits up the bridge. He actually has no power. He has to speak to people who have power. Shut down the engine. The captain can't just sit there and go, I'm going to shut down the engine. All he can do is say, shut down the engine. Then people have to obey that order. And hopefully, if the captain gives a stupid order, the people say, hey, boss, you can't do that because, you know, this is going to happen. As the ship is navigating out, remember that on board isn't just the captain, but there is a pilot belonging to the port who is there to move him through specific things. So the bridge is actually under the control of the pilot. So if the captain was conspiring, he'd have to have the pilot on board. And the pilot isn't going to do that because it's his job to make it safe. If he fails, he'll never be a pilot again, go to jail. So I don't think that this was a deliberate attack. I do think that this was a tragic accident.
All right. Anything's possible, but not likely. What class did you play and what is that? Is that a game?
World of Warcraft. That's the question I answered earlier. I only play one character and I haven't played him in a long time now. That's why I was sort of excited. Somebody else in there, Scott's just using this as an excuse to play World of Warcraft. You're damn right.
You're not allowed to make money. You're not allowed to have fun. You should have a life of misery and poverty.
I started out as a combat rogue orc for the Horde. I started in the Birding Crusade. Unfortunately, I didn't get to play vanilla WoW originally, but I transitioned into the Wrath of the Lich King, which I think was the greatest expansion ever, and became one of the best combat orcs in Grizzly Hills Realm. And for a while there, I was considered to be pretty damn good at the game. I don't know where I stand today. I think I'm pretty damn bad because I don't play anymore. Unfortunately, I've got reality to deal with, and plus my daughter stopped playing. One of the attractions was that my daughters, we formed a guild, you know, and so my daughters and I would run around, and we don't know what we were doing, just run around getting our asses kicked, but we enjoyed having a little guild, and we enjoyed doing quests together and all that. And then I got involved in raiding, and then they sort of gravitated away from the game, and it no longer holds the allure. So that's why I thought maybe doing this Twitch thing might make WoW fun again.
All right. Let's take one last question. This person looks like they typed the question with their toes. Missed quite a few letters here. Scott, could you talk about the Houthi claim that they successfully tested a hypersonic missile?
Well, the interesting thing about doing a test, what kind of test was it? Was it a ground launch? How do you know it's hypersonic then? I guess you could. You could say that, igniting the engine on the ground, it goes through certain performance characteristics, and then you could postulate that had this been in the air, it would have been hypersonic. But then there's a whole bunch of other things that have to happen to make just the propulsion system. It has to be attached to an airframe that's capable of sustaining hypersonic speeds and all that. So in order to truly say that you have a hypersonic test, you'd have to test it, flight test it, and we detect those things. We would detect it range, so we would know too. So it would be strange if the Houthi did a flight test of a system that they called a hypersonic missile, and the Americans went, no. That's like me, saying I drove at the Nürburgring in Germany and implied that somehow I was out there driving like it was Le Mans. But I, in fact, got in a VW bug and I never broke the 40-mile mark because the curves were too severe for me. That's an analogy not too many people might understand. I realized that the second I started saying it, but I went with it.
At least you're right that it's an analogy. And the camel under the nose, the camel's nose under the tent is a metaphor. I finally have some degree of clarity over the difference between those two. That's one of the great benefits of having done this podcast with you over a period of time, Scott. I finally learned the difference.
An old dog has learned new tricks.
That is right. All right, that'll do it for this week's episode of Ask the Inspector. We will not be on this Friday night, so please join us next Tuesday night at 3, and then the following Friday we'll be back as usual. If you are one of those people who don't mind throwing a few bucks our way, you can subscribe to Scott Ritter Extra. You also have the option of subscribing for free. That's at scottritterextra.com. Maybe Yelena will be on top of her game and flash that on the screen. Another way we could make a few bucks is from merchandise. We have some t-shirts. There's one of them. And we also have a female version. By the way, Yelena told me that she received hers in the mail and will soon be modeling it for us. So that's something to look forward to. And we also have the Scott Ritter Challenge coin. This is the coin he gave out when he visited last May. And that's available at scottrittermerch.com, as is autographed copies of Scott's most recent book, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, also at scottrittermerch.com. Thanks to Yelena.
If people want to donate to the movie, they can donate to wagingpeace.fund.
Oh, my God. I love it when you remember all that. And we have a new website coming soon, scottritter.com. For now, that URL is forwarding to a Shopify website page that has all our info. But we'll give a more proper thank you when we have the website to the nice man who got us that URL. And I guess that will do it. So thanks, Scott. Thanks, Yelena. Thanks to our beloved audience. Join us next Tuesday at the same time.
Thank you.